if you ask entrepreneurs, which we did every 6 months, we surveyed them. That was the most valuable thing we did, was open doors. So I would like to think we opened a couple of helpful doors for Evidation early on in its life that helped. But ultimately, it was just really the will of the founders to keep going, to really believe in their own idea and not need that sort of big venture check as outside validation. And I think being an underdog, being sort of not the most popular company, not the one that's like at the top of every list, has always served the company well. It's kind of the ethos of the company. I mean, it's run by two women. It's a very unusual sort of setup in the valley. And I think being an underdog is part of its kind of ethos and culture.
And now, from San Francisco and the UCSF Rosenman Institute, the Health Technology Podcast, with your host, Christine Winoto.
Our guest today is Malay Gandhi, partner at the PC firm Ensemble Labs and senior VP for business operation at Evidation Health. He spent his whole career so far in the healthcare space, motivated by a catastrophic accident one of his family members suffered when Malay was a teenager. Previously, Malay was CEO of Rock Health, which he joined in 2012 as an intern. How did he make that jump, you may ask? Well, he was an unusually talented and experienced intern. He cold called his way into Rock Health during a sabbatical he was taking after 7 years in management consulting at Deloitte. During his Deloitte years, he had shuttled from one high-level corporate assignment to another across the globe, building a deep understanding of how to solve problems and persuade people. You will learn that he has an incredible focus on detail and communication, particularly in pitch deck. Get your pitch deck right, and at least people won't be asking, "See that typo? What else should we worry about with this company?" And I hope you enjoy our conversation. And if you like what you hear today, please subscribe to our podcast and your favorite app. Well, thank you, Malay, for joining me today in San Francisco. And I don't know where you are, but I appreciate you taking the time to share with all our community your story. And I'd like to always start about how you get started to where you are today. I know you're in healthcare, but you know, when you look at your background, have you ever imagined that you'll be in healthcare?
Well, thanks for having me on. I am here in San Francisco during this very weird time, as we were saying at the beginning. You know, I don't know exactly when healthcare was sort of the decided choice for me, or you know, now looking back, that it would be, you know, more than half my life being spent in the space. I did, when you know, I was younger, when I was around 13 years old, we had kind of a traumatic accident in our family, and my you know, I just ended up spending a lot of time in the hospital and rehab facilities for the next couple of months. Not me personally, it didn't happen to me, but it happened to a very close family member. Mm-hmm. And that following summer, so I think I was around 14, I was in high school. And our local medical school, I lived in Morgantown, West Virginia. We have a state university there. There was a medical school there. And they had a program for high school students to do research, basically work as research assistants. Mm-hmm. As folks who have PhDs can attest, cheap labor is always good. And so a very kind professor, this woman, Dr. Adrienne Salm, took me into her lab, and I remember visiting with a few of the different labs beforehand, and she was the first person to ever show me, you know, brains, human brains, and I just became kind of fascinated in neuro and the neuroanatomy space, and I started working in her lab that summer, and that really continued. It started sort of a spark and an interest in science, and I ended up working in a few different labs from the time I was about 14 to sort of around 21 or so, basically for the first year after undergrad. And, you know, I've kind of just never looked back. I've worked almost exclusively in the healthcare space. Mm-hmm. Since then. And so, yeah, just, it kind of started with a bizarre accident and a choice to work in a lab. But I don't know that I was ever really intentional about it. Or I'm 38 now. The time from when I was 21 to 38, it's been an unbelievable ride. But I don't know that I ever was, you know, that intentional about it.
It's interesting. Sometimes a very traumatic experience can shape who we are without realizing. Until you look back, then you kind of you can point it out maybe more so than at that time. Maybe.
Yeah, I mean, I think the part of it for me is, you know, I was a kid, I was naive. I was like, oh well, I'll go in the lab. The accident was a spinal cord injury, so you think like, well, I'll figure it out. You know, like there has to be something we can do. We can learn about, you know, the neuro system, and there must be some way to fix it. And later, when I had a close family member with late stage cancer, I was, you know, working at Dana-Farber, like there's got to be a clinical trial. There's got to be a way to fix it. And as a management consultant, I mean, you're trained to just run headfirst into new problems as a person who doesn't know what they're doing. And so to me, certainly like maybe trauma brought me to healthcare, but the thing, there's always this naiveness I have of like, well, I can figure it out. There's a problem, but we can figure it out. There's a way to like learn and understand it. And many times I've never solved the problem. The problems turn out to be, you know, extraordinarily challenging and difficult, but it certainly served me well to run at problems and have the willingness to kind of to solve them. Yeah.
Yeah. You mentioned a little bit that you did work at management consulting before you hop onto the different company and startups. What did that teach you being in a management consultant?
Yeah, there was a lot of different things. So that's kind of like chapter two. So I come out of the labs, I go to grad school, I study health policy, and then I go into management consulting as somebody who had never put on a suit or, you know, like wore a tie, you know, had never heard of the field of management consulting, to be honest. And so I think probably the biggest takeaways now looking back, I left consulting, you know, over 8 years ago now. I think the biggest things for me, number one, were all the soft skills. So every 6 to 12 weeks, being sort of moved to a new job with a new set of people, solving a new problem. You know, you're going from sort of Quad Cities, Iowa, to San Juan, Puerto Rico, to Madison, Wisconsin, or Manhattan, New York, just really different groups of people and different problems, different companies. I kind of felt like I'd seen everything in terms of people to work with and how to work with them. So I just learned a lot about how to work with others and how not to work with others, how to communicate, you know, with the things that we were doing and thought were most sort of impactful. So there was just a really important set of soft skills about how to work with others in really diverse environments. It goes back to this kind of problem solving aspect of ramping up quickly and getting through something, getting to answers as quickly as possible. And then I would say the other piece that I really reflect on positively was, you know, you become good at the narrative, you become good at the story, you're really trying to convince some pretty smart people to do things or to believe in things. And sometimes things that they didn't believe before, you know, it wasn't always about like confirming things that they already wanted to do or already believed in. By they, I mean our clients. And so, yeah, I just became a more powerful storyteller through that experience.
I mean, I was talking to a few folks on the entrepreneurs. Many of them had a technical background, and they tend to be on the left brainer side rather than the right brainer. And sometimes convincing people, we were told, is not just about the data, but the other side. Do you think that's the case? That how you can convince people better with your story?
You know, I think one thing I learned, for better or worse, is a lot about human psychology. You know, of you, it's not always about the best reasoned sort of argument. We were trained on the Minto principle, which was actually like you give the answer first and then you unfold the data later. And I think it's like the psychological component of that for me was, you know, there was sort of a visceral thing that you are trying to evoke very early on and sort of any presentation. And the big the big takeaways from a, I'm laughing because, you know, like from a style sort of perspective, I transitioned from consulting to, you know, to sort of early stage startup companies. Mm-hmm. And that storytelling and that narrative and everything else became important again. And I really pushed a lot of companies, and it's a personal thing of like, well, our story has to be tight and crisp and make sense. And you should be able to read all the headlines. And the pixels should be in the right places because there's a psychology to it. There's an emotion to it. And so if our slides look bad, right, you know, that's what it'll distract people. They'll be like, well, why does the slide look this way? Or why is there this typo? And I think it's hard for people who haven't had sort of that experience or think about, spend a lot of time thinking about what is the other, what is the emotion or feeling somebody's going to get from this slide? And they're just focused on, as you said, maybe they're more technical, like, well, I just need to convince them. I just need to make the best argument. And they kind of forget the psychological piece of it. And so I'm pretty obsessive about like graphic design and the way the slides are presented, the exact unfolding of sort of the story. And honestly, it was very early on when I, you know, sort of joined Rock Health, that was the calling card. It was like why startups, why these founders wanted to work with me is because I was good at pitch decks. Like I just built a better pitch deck that evoked more sort of emotion. And it doesn't mean the data doesn't have to unfold later. That wasn't the learning. That's again, like the Minto sort of pyramid principle is the data better be there, but you might not even get to it. You might not have the time. The person's attention might be lost before that if you kind of started from that stuff. It was to get to the point and get to the answer very quickly, and then let the rest of the narrative unfold from there.
Yeah, no, I have shared that experience in a way because I went to investment banking world prior to the business school. I was doing more science work, and then when I arrived in the investment banking world, everything is all about presentation, how everything has to be lined up, all those things, and you'd be like, why is that important? And you quickly learn if you don't deliver that kind of product, they will throw it right in front of your face.
Yeah. And no one can really, I found like, no one can really trace it back to some place of like, and really explain it in a crisp manner why it matters. You just get this sense of like, it does matter. And there's a reason why it gets thrown back in your face is because there's a recognition that people notice things that you've taken care when you deliver it. And they definitely notice the opposite when you haven't taken that care. It's sort of distracting at best.
Yes,
is the way that I think about it.
And I think people can, you know, people always try to pay attention to the little things that the unrevealing characters that people, you know, picked on. If you don't mm-hmm. even care about these small details, you wonder what else if they don't care about. I think
that, yeah, that's it's such a good point, and it's so true. And it's something that you have to teach young people that it wasn't about the typo; it was about the principle of it, of what else does this say? Like, this isn't right. So no one ran spell check on this. So now what are all the other things we should be worried about or thinking about? It's not about that typo. It's about like the overall process and the guidelines or the principle of what we're doing.
I think that is, I'm glad that you mentioned that because I think a lot of the time, it does, I mean, especially when you see a lot of pitch deck, you can see one that is really well was polished and one is not, then, you know, it's easier to understand. Like, I think your brain open up much, you know, open easier than if you see something that's so messy, I guess.
Yeah. And I think it took me a while to figure out how to communicate this to more technical people of, you know, why are you changing my slides? Like, you actually haven't altered the core message in any way, but the slides are all different sort of now. And the explanation that I found worked the best was your slides are getting in the way of your message. They're distracting people from the point you're trying to make. That was the clearest articulation I could give and the one that activated people the most of, oh, okay, well, I don't want that. I don't want my slides to get in the way of my message, you know, like I don't, but it does. It can really take away from the things you're doing. And I don't think it's just about slides, it's about words. It's just generally this abstract concept of communication that these things actually do matter because it evokes some response in the other party. And we should choose them with care.
Yeah. I felt I mean, I know, like, I have a 13-year-old. You know, a lot of people talk about STEM, which is great, but I think what I felt is missing is the about communication skill, which I think they need to be taught pretty early on as well, how to communicate. And oftentimes we see a technical founders, they're really good in their technical skill, but then they cannot tell their story and then they're missing out.
Mm-hmm.
And so
yeah, they can't achieve the things they want to achieve.
Right.
This podcast is sponsored by Brown Ratnick's Global Life Sciences Group, a team of legal professionals that helps life science companies, lenders, and investors around the world turn good science into good business. Learn more at brownratnick.com.
So from the management consultant, you said that that's where you went to Rock Hill. Is that how?
Yeah, that's exactly it. So that was 2012. I had taken a sabbatical from my management consulting job. Deloitte had a very generous sabbatical policy, and I had cold called Rock Health because they were doing when Rock Health was an accelerator. They had a cohort in Boston, which is where I lived at the time. And just said, hey, can I come work for the summer? My company, I have a paid sabbatical, I'll work for free. And so in 2012, I joined Rock Health as an intern, actually, with the Boston. That was the third cohort of companies with the Boston cohort. And that was kind of the start of this chapter of my career focused more on health tech, both in kind of like the investing side and now the operating side.
And so you just end up loving that job?
It was an instant. So I didn't fall in love with it on the first day. To be honest, I fell in love with it over a period of time, probably over the course of all of my time. It's a difficult transition, you know, going from kind of like management consulting, pretty controlled experiences. At that point, like I had been a consultant for 7 or 8 years. You're used to kind of like leading projects, working with Fortune 100 healthcare company. You just develop a whole set of things you're accustomed to, and it was definitely a big challenge or shift. There's a minor ego thing to it of, well, I used to be in executive committees and boardrooms with the largest healthcare companies on the planet, and now I'm an intern, you know, making sure our speakers and guests and mentors like know where to go. And so I think what really kind of sparked my energy was once the entrepreneurs in that cohort got to know me and I got to know them, and we found some things that we could work on together where I felt I was really helping the companies in a way that they weren't able to do sort of on their own. It was something, you know, sort of unique to me, whether it was like understanding the healthcare industry or some of this kind of pitch deck stuff. That was one. I just needed some activation from the entrepreneurs. I could do something impactful here. And I really loved the people. They were really sort of quite unique, the entrepreneurs were. That was like part one. I think part two was, it was so visceral, the feedback, you know, on the businesses. And I don't mean from investors, from the market, from customers. I remember telling one company, well, let's run some surveys. Like, let's do some market research, you know, a couple thousand people. Well, like, we can get a survey out, we can get some results back. And the founder, Jeff, he's just looking at me like, I don't have any money to do that. We don't have the time to do it. Like, go outside. We're sitting in Longwood Medical. Like, just go over to Beth Israel, stand outside and see who'll talk to you. Like, we got to go much, much faster. Or, you know, you'd propose a pricing strategy and they would talk to the customer the next day and be like, no, they're definitely not going to accept this. And so that piece was long and sometimes totally opaque, almost invisible in management consulting. So many decks and so many recommendations, but very little real feedback on, hey, did this work or did it not work? And that was one of the most frustrating parts of consulting for me, and why I love things like M&A integration and restructuring, because you could just really see the results from things like that. But the corporate strategy always felt more academic than, as I said, visceral. And with the startups, it was, you know, sink or swim. Every day was about improving and learning something. And that was the other piece that really activated me.
So for some of our listeners, I think most of the people probably have heard of Rock Health, and maybe you can tell us more about what, when you were there, Raquel, what it was and what, how is it transformed to where it is now?
Yeah, I mean, Raquel was founded in 2011 by two business school classmates. The founder, Hallie Tecco, she recognized an opportunity at the intersection of healthcare and technology that I don't think anyone really saw at that time. And in fact, it was really because of Hallie, like the term digital health came to prominence. I'm not saying that it had never been used before, but it definitely hadn't been used actively before Raquel sort of existed. And she had a background that had given her some exposure to know that there was an unmet need there. And really through sheer force of will, she started Raquel. And there's a Harvard Business School case study, I won't like rehash it, but about like, what is the right sort of corporate structure for Raquel? It's actually like one of the core questions of the HBS case study. Long story short, it ended up being started as a nonprofit. There were corporate sort of partners, both nonprofits and for-profits, that gave, technically 501c3 donations to Raquel. Raquel then issued grants to startup companies, and they did it in batches like an accelerator. So it took some components of like what Y Combinator was, this sort of cohort-based accelerator model, and then funded the companies with $10,000 to $20,000 grant. So that started in 2011. There's a bunch of different components of evolution we went through sort of while I was there. But the first thing that happened was on the funding side. That changed. It went from sort of, we were taking money from corporate partners and then making these sort of distributions or funding companies through grants, to very similar to Y Combinator. There was a startup fund that was funded by four different firms, Kleiner Perkins, Mayo, and two others, where they were now giving $100,000 per company that we sort of mutually selected. That was in the fall of 2012. We closed that and announced it. And then in the subsequent years, we scaled up some of the corporate partnerships and sort of the research efforts. And then I raised a formal venture fund. So we raised it from LPs. And then we were investing, we increased our check size sort of into the companies. So rather than them directly investing, the four entities directly investing in the companies, we actually raised a fund and started investing that basically right at the end of 2014. And we announced the close of the accelerator. We have a short podcast here, so I won't explain all of the reasons we did it. Just, we didn't ultimately feel it served entrepreneurs best, and they were really our customers and our market. And so we raised a fund and still stayed seed focused, increased our check size, and invested out of that fund until I left at the end of 2015. And that fund still exists. Raquel still invests out of it. I think most of those sort of guiding principles still sort of remain at Raquel, about being oriented primarily around startups and the entrepreneurs.
That's good. And so you are now at Evidation. And can you tell us more? I mean, Evidation was also a company that was Raquel supported.
Yeah, it's hard to believe. Also around sort of 8 years ago, I think it graduated or had its demo day as part of the second Raquel cohort. And, the sort of amazing thing about Evidation is the founders came not from healthcare, but from technology, and in specific from ad tech. And they had this idea in their minds that there was going to be a new and emerging class of quote unquote big data, particularly from sensors, things like Fitbit and others. And if they could harness that data and use it for good, use it for health, use it for behavior change, which is what they had done in their prior company, but they were using mobile phone data and they were using it for advertising. And, they had really done something special with their prior company. They didn't even know what to call sort of the underlying quote unquote algorithms. They called it computer learning because the term machine learning wasn't wasn't common. So there's like a New York Times feature, and many of the people who worked in data science there have gone on to company, like lead it at companies like Netflix and others. So they were really pioneers in how to use novel large scale data to drive behavior change. It just happened to be the outcome was ads. It was how to, you know, get people to use more hotels or whatever else. And they really wanted to aim that gun at healthcare. And so they probably couldn't have been more wrong about the timing. I don't think the co-founders would feel bad about me saying that. They were really, really early. But it's a true story of persistence in that belief and iterating and staying alive until you sort of find the right timing and the right market for that model. And so it's been something that's really special and frankly, like important for people who live in the Valley to sort of watch these experiences, because it's not a straight line, and the straight line is definitely not up and to the right. It's sort of these crazy waves that companies go through. And so, yeah, I'll just say it again. It's been very special to be able to kind of watch that, and then to be able to join the company 2 years ago and get it again in the sense of like visceralness, like getting really down to bare metal. You go from being a consultant, telling others what to do. You're an investor, so at least you're putting your money where your mouth is. You're betting. And I would like to think I worked, you know, I tried to work pretty side by side with the entrepreneurs, but it's very different than being inside the company. So it's been a very unique experience to see that evolution and see where they've made it now.
It's kind of nice to see how, you know, it's so interesting because some people start from the operation side, goes the other way around. And some, like in your case, you go, you know, the opposite direction. And, you know, some people say like it's better to learn from the operation and go the other way. But I think either way is a great learning experience. And you mentioned earlier about everyday, you know, staying alive. You were part of the Rock Health at that time. So you got to see like what kind of support that you provide them to help them to stay alive until the time is right.
Yeah. I mean, I think companies need capital in some way. And I think sometimes we don't distinguish between investor capital and customer capital, like money from revenue, from selling something. And I think Evidation, they were able to construct a couple pretty significant enterprise healthcare deals. One was with Sanofi. That's one of the very early relationships that the company had. And then another one with Humana, the large payer. And so with what I would call nominal investor capital, early on at sort of the seed stage, they were actually really primarily funded through customer from customer revenue. And that allowed them to sort of cycle through some different business models. That was probably 2012, through the end of 2014. And then right at the end of 2014, the Series A capital raise sort of came in, and it's kind of been off to the races from then on. So I think the first, and I shouldn't tell the founder's story. You should have them come on and tell it from their point of view. But my view was they didn't have, you know, the right super early explosive product market fit. And so it was these kind of experiments, but pretty well-funded ones with enterprise, like large scale enterprise healthcare companies. And I think Evidation Rock Health as a policy would never, ever take credit for an entrepreneur's work, especially when you work with them. You realize they work infinitely harder and take on infinitely more risk than any investor or even supporter, advisor, anyone else sort of does. I do think we were helpful with some, the biggest thing that Rock Health did, what the entrepreneurs always cited as the most valuable, was just door opening. So Rock Health, what Hallie did such a great job of, was building this brand as we were a convener. We were the intersection of healthcare and technology, digital health. And so everyone just sort of showed up. Like the industry was there, and startups were there, and sort of the quasi-governmental and nonprofits. Everyone kind of came to our door. And so being able to connect startups with the industry, if you ask entrepreneurs, which we did every 6 months, we surveyed them, that was the most valuable thing we did, was open doors. So I would like to think we opened a couple of helpful doors for Evidation early on in its life that helped. But ultimately, it was just really the will of the founders to keep going, to really believe in their own idea and not need that sort of big venture check as outside validation. And I think being an underdog, being sort of not the most popular company, not the one that's like at the top of every list, has always served the company well. It's kind of the ethos of the company. I mean, it's run by two women. It's a very unusual sort of setup in the Valley. And I think being an underdog is part of its kind of ethos and culture.
Yeah, I think it's good to be underdog, because the thing, you know, you can always operate under the radar and then just like shoot up, blossom.
Yeah, I agree.
You're probably willing to take more risks, because like, what do you get to lose?
Yeah, I think that's well said. And once you get to the top, there's a lot to lose. And so you can lose some of your nerve there, right, for sure. Yeah.
So, I mean, we saw the news with the collaboration that Evidation have with BARDA. I thought that's really exciting. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah. So the relationship with BARDA started a couple years ago, and leading into this flu season. So obviously before the pandemic, so the 2019-2020 flu season, we were already working with them on a large scale ILI, influenza-like illness program. And then going back multiple years, going back to the 2017 influenza season, Evidation has had a pretty robust research effort around detecting ILI using sensor-based data, and had presented some of our early research a couple of years ago at the at an epidemiological conference. And so, you know, when coronavirus hit, I think there was definitely a desire, obviously, for many people in the company to try to help. In fact, two of the co-founders are Italian, like born and raised in Italy. And so it was very personal for them, because Italy was obviously being ravaged before really the US case rate started to lift. And so we looked at a number of programs we had running in ILI for the season, including this work with BARDA, and Gates was involved with that. It included the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation were involved with that. It included home diagnostics. And then we had this other very large scale participatory surveillance effort going around nationwide. And so we just began that conversation with BARDA about what to do, and with some of those programs we already had running, as well as new programs. And so the scope of this collaboration, I think, really builds on Evidation's core competency and experience with communicable diseases. It's kind of it wasn't an overnight thing. This was many, many years of really hard work by our research team to prove we had these types of capabilities, and then a really strong effort from our business development team to work with BARDA on this program, and then bring Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation into that program. And hopefully we'll have more to announce. There's you know, other partners that might participate in that. But the scope of it is really about early warning systems. How do you understand when somebody's sick and they don't know that they're sick sort of yet, and certainly the people around them don't know that. And we had seen promising signal for doing that with ILI, and then we just released on preprint some of our work around coronavirus with this kind of early detection using sensor data. And that's what it's really focused on. And we're starting with a small cohort of high risk individuals, because that's where we would like things, and we'll scale it up from there.
Is that what the EMT, is that why, because of that reason?
Yeah, I think that healthcare professionals will be a big part of it. I think other essential workers too could be part of this program. But we want to start with the people who probably have the highest risk of exposure. Those are the folks that we think obviously would benefit the most right now. But it also, honestly, like from a study perspective, and you know, Dr. Fauci's talking about this with the vaccine as well. If there's no infections, then there's no program. Like, you don't have any ground truth on who's sick and who's not sick. And look, that would be a great problem to have. We don't believe that's where we're going to be over the coming months, that there's literally zero infections. But if you want to be able to generate data from people who are sick and people who are healthy, we have to be in a place where there's higher risk of exposure, which is certainly with our essential workers. I mean, I don't think that precludes others, and I definitely don't think it precludes interest from the general public about these types of warning systems, of getting a better sense for, like, am I sick or not sick, or you're starting to feel something. Is there a role for some of this kind of passively collected sensor data and helping people understand whether they might be coming down with an infection or not?
Yeah. And I think that sort of technology would help people understand whether they can go back to work or not. And I think that is also a challenge right now, trying to figure out who can come back to work.
Yeah, it's a big challenge, and we're not ready to obviously make any claims about that. In general, what we find is there's never one answer. There's never a silver bullet. There's not some perfect system. So you could use temperature, you could use RT-PCR, or you could use sensor data and resting heart rate. You can use patient-reported data that can answer 8 questions. You know, it's really about, like, what's most accessible, what gives you some signal, how is that data, then that interpretation being used, you know. And our goal very broadly as a company is to move clinically actionable information all the way out to the edge, you know, and these technologies, wearing an Apple Watch, and maybe you're wearing a Fitbit or whatever else, are becoming more and more accessible. And so if we can use that information, that data, to create something, use that data to create information that gives us a clinical insight, then we want to, because it lives out on the edge. It's passively sort of collected, and we can partner it with other data sources or sets, even just questioning people. But we tend not to find there's, like, some one-to-one relationship, like, oh, if your resting heart rate changes this much, you have coronavirus. That's way too simplistic. Although people will make all sorts of claims about, like, well, the temperatures in the country are down, so coronavirus is basically, like, fine, like, we've solved it. And it's just, you know, it's overly simplistic for something as complex as this. And so I think the thing a lot of people at the company are really proud of with the BARDA work is that the entire data set will be released publicly, obviously, like, de-identified. But we'll release it because we feel that others should, you know, learn from it and benefit from that work. And it's the same thing we would ask of anyone collecting data during this time around early warning systems, is share the data, like, let people work on this problem together.
Yeah. So, well, that's great. Well, thank you so much for sharing your insight and your advice for startups. It's definitely a challenging time, but I think even the challenging time will eventually end. So we'll get there somehow.
Yeah, I'm confident we'll see the other side of this. I don't know the timing, but we'll get through it.
Yeah, great. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening today. And don't forget to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes.